This is CliffCentral.com. Love,
love, love. All right. Anne Marie, do you remember her, Ben?
Yes, Gareth, sure.
What do you remember?
Her name's Anne Marie. She's
That's good.
She's a talented young singer.
Yeah.
She's recorded some material in the last 5 years. She did that song,
that Ciao Adios, I'm Done.
Yeah, she's got quite a happy poppy sort of way about her.
People like her.
Yeah. Nailed it.
It's all right. I hope you're having a good start to your day. It's Friday. It's 7:04. Now, we didn't have the burning platform yesterday because Justice Malala is in the Caribbean. But I'm very happy that we've managed to track down an old friend of ours, someone who we really like to talk to, Simon Allison, who's the Africa editor for The Mail and Guardian. And he's actually on the line for this morning's special Africa focus on the burning platform. He's joining us now via Skype. Simon, how are you?
Well, guys, I'm not in the Caribbean, so that should answer your question.
Yeah, but don't be jealous. We're very happy to speak to you again. It's been a long time.
It has indeed. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. Are you still very much focused on what's going on all over this exciting continent of ours?
I am indeed, although it's increasingly hard to keep track. 55 countries and amazing things going on in every one of them.
Well, since this is the burning platform, let's start with the most burning issue, corruption at the African Union. The AU, when we do pay attention to it, doesn't really seem to get a lot done, never really did, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt. What's happening over there right now?
You know, the AU has always presented actually quite a good front. If you go to the African Union building in Addis, it's a beautiful building, although it was built by the Chinese at vast expense. Everyone, you know, is busy. There's lots going on. There's lots of resolutions. But more and more over the last few months, sort of stories have been emerging that, you know, not all is right within the sort of inner workings of the organization itself. So it began, you know, a couple of months ago, the Mail and Guardian actually ran an investigation into sort of institutional sexism at the AU. And what was happening was that dozens of senior female staff had all signed a memo to the chairperson saying, look, there is a professional apartheid, that's the word they used, going on at the African Union. Women are just not being appointed to senior positions. So that was the first thing. That was the first sign that, you know, not all is right. And then yesterday, we learned some quite extraordinary news. The African Union has an advisory board on corruption. Now, this board is supposed to, you know, help the organization fight corruption, make sure that no corruption is happening sort of both continentally, but also within the organization itself. It's a great initiative. Mm-hmm. Except one of the board members resigned, saying that corruption is sort of endemic at the AU itself, that he keeps trying to raise issues of corruption, both to the board and to the commission more generally, and no one listens. No one takes any action. And he said, enough is enough. I can't do this anymore. I am resigning. And crucially, I'm going to release my resignation letter. Now, there is a kind of culture of silence among African Union employees. They don't like to talk.
Yeah.
It's a sort of omerta.
You don't let other people into your own family feud.
Exactly. You know, washing dirty linen in public and all of that. But slowly, that is beginning to sort of crack and people are talking. And it paints a very disturbing picture of what's going on. Now, my question, what I haven't figured out yet and what I'm really interested in, is this all happening, you know, over the last few months? But this is, you know, at the beginning of last year, 2017, we had that change of leadership at the African Union. So Nkosi Zana Dlamini Zuma, who, of course, we know very well, left the organization. And she was replaced by a guy from Chad, Moussa Faki Mahamat.
Sorry, say that again, because that's a good name. Do that one again.
It's a great name. It's a
Moussa Faki what?
Moussa Faki Mahamat. He's from Chad. He's a very experienced diplomat. And what I want to know is did these problems begin under his watch, or were they always there And Dlamini Zuma was just better at managing them. And we haven't got an answer for that yet, but we're looking into it.
Yeah, it seems to me the biggest problem the AU has is that nobody really sees them doing anything.
Which is a pity.
Whether there are men or women in charge. I mean, every time there's a major incident in Africa, we seem to go to the UN to find out what to do, not the AU. You know what I mean?
It's true, and there is that perception. But I actually disagree. I think the AU is really important. And sure, it doesn't do very well on the big political and sort of conflict stuff. Like, you know, when it comes to solving South Sudan or Burundi, or monitoring elections and sort of giving them a stamp of credibility when they're not really credible, the AU doesn't do a great job. But it's on a lot of other stuff.
Yeah,
that's
stuff,
sort of smaller, more detailed, things like... You know, at the moment, they're negotiating to create this new continental free trade area, which is going to open up borders between countries. And sure, it's still, you know, very much in its initial stages. But stuff like that is going to revolutionize how this continent works. And the AU is the only institution that can make that happen. And it is doing, you know, it's doing what it can, but it is a fundamentally flawed body. And it's very different from, for example, the European Union. Because the European Union is it's a members-only club with a very exclusive invitation list. Like, you have to be asked to join the EU. You have to, like, come with standards and, you know, there are high requirements to join the EU. The AU, everyone can join. Just by dint of being an African country, you get to be a member. And that means that, you know, everyone is, even countries that probably shouldn't be members of an organization that likes to say it is democratic and anti-corruption and all of that sort of thing.
All right, let's leave the AU alone because, I mean, you've helped to kind of sketch what's really going on there for us. But I have to say that their PR is really not up to scratch because it just seems to me every time there's a story about them, it's about how badly they do something, not how well. The so-called Islamist insurgency in northern Mozambique. We've been talking on this show, I've had you as a guest a number of times, and we've spoken about this southern spread of militant Islamism. Is this a real thing? Is something happening in northern Mozambique that we need to be aware of?
So, Gareth, let me just be honest and say I have absolutely no idea. And no one else I've spoken to does. What's been happening in northern Mozambique? So since about October last year, in October, suddenly a bunch of police stations were attacked by an armed group. You know, guns were stolen, some people were killed. The army responded very violently. There's been a sort of tit for tat going on. It's been brutal. People have been beheaded. The army have been accused of extrajudicially killing people. And we're talking, like, you know, in the last month alone, I think Human Rights Watch said 39 people had been killed. 400 homes in this northern province, Cabo Delgado, had been burnt to the ground, and more than 1,000 people displaced from their homes, though that number is probably much higher. Now, the government is saying that these are Islamists. They're using the word Al-Shabaab to describe them. Now, Al-Shabaab, of course, we know from Somalia, although there's no suggestion that it's the same group. It's just that, you know, these local militants are maybe using that name.
And we've heard examples before of where governments have used the threat of and the supposed existence of some external group to conduct some very nasty operations of their own.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is certainly a fear that there's an element of that going on in Mozambique. You know, someone who monitors Mozambican media told me that it was actually Mozambican state radio that used Al-Shabaab for the first time, that term.
Hmm.
It hadn't been heard anywhere else. So
little
Mozambican
bit
state radio
is
very
a little bit suspicious,
controlled.
Don't you think?
It gets more suspicious.
Yeah.
Two things that really make me worry. Number one is Cabo Delgado, this northern province, is where all of Mozambique's natural gas reserves are located.
Yeah. I'm surprised Dick Cheney isn't involved in that case.
Well, actually, you are very close to the mark because a certain Eric Prince, who you might remember as the head of Blackwater Private Security, has just signed a deal to go into a joint venture with a Mozambican company that is involved in billions of dollars worth of corruption, and is also reportedly in the prospect of signing a deal for $850 million to provide security for Cabo Delgado province.
Let's just remind people, Blackwater was a very big story in the late 2000s, you know, the first 10 years of this century, and they were linked very closely to operations that were being conducted by American companies in Iraq and Afghanistan, but more especially Iraq, and around oil and around private security. And they had massive kind of government tenders to provide infrastructure and security in Iraq at the time, and particularly in the green zone of Baghdad. And there was quite a lot of controversy around Eric Prince, the CEO of this company. They were building in America a lot of sites that were kind of off the grid, that also had to do with government operations, secret government operations. And they continue to operate sort of somewhere in between the private security world and the world of criminal intelligence, with a couple of overlaps into some very dark government departments. Am I right?
That about sums it up.
Yeah, so now these guys are coming into northern Mozambique, huh? And how convenient that there's an enemy that's appeared out of nowhere for them to fight.
Well, exactly. You wonder what comes first, the Islamist insurgency or Eric Prince?
I think we know. Okay, let's talk about the build-up in Zimbabwe to elections. We've heard this story before, but Bob Mugabe wasn't there before. Do we have any hope that the elections that will be conducted in Zimbabwe next will be free and fair? Do we have any feeling about whether or not international observers will have the hard time that they had before? Whether neighboring African countries will be able to express themselves in an honest way about what goes on there, and whether or not the people are feeling confident about going into this election?
You know, it's such an interesting election because on the face of it, it's so different. You know, Robert Mugabe is gone. We have Emmerson Mnangagwa coming in. And then on the opposition, you don't have Morgan Tsvangirai, who, of course, was an icon in his own right, and had also stayed in that position for probably longer than he should have. You've got Nelson Chamisa, who's this 40-year-old lawyer, young, energetic. And, you know, you start thinking, oh, well, look, this is wonderful. Change has come to Zimbabwe. We have a new democratic competition. And then you start looking a little closer and you realize actually nothing has changed. And what is very clever about the way this election is being managed is that a lot of the major issues have been sort of taken care of long before the election begins. You know, and I'm talking specifically about the voters' roll. You know, this is the register of who is allowed to vote, who is not allowed to vote. And there are huge issues around that voters' roll, huge fears that it has been manipulated with, you know, who people have been excluded from it. It has been inflated.
Weren't there? Yeah, there were something like a couple of 100,000 dead people who were still on the voters' roll last time we checked.
There were. And so those, you know, that was kind of used by the government, and this process began under Mugabe, as a sort of, okay, we're going to reform the voters' roll because, you know, we've got these hundreds of thousands of dead people. But the sort of mechanisms of that reform have been a little bit murky. So what the big worry is from civil society is that, you know, people who think they should be allowed to vote come election day will not be allowed to vote. And the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, although it has a new chair and, you know, says it's turned a new leaf, is the same old Zimbabwe Electoral Commission who has overseen several elections that were certainly less than free and fair. So what that means, if this theory is true, is that Emmerson Mnangagwa and ZANU-PF can actually run a perfectly clean election otherwise.
So they probably have nothing to worry about, is what you're telling me.
That's what civil society seem to be suggesting. That's the great fear.
And the feeling of the ordinary people on the street, is this something that disempowers them, or is it something that they feel is in some way an improvement on their condition under Robert Mugabe?
I don't know. It varies very much from sort of person to person, but there does seem to be a feeling of sort of let's give the new regime the benefit of the doubt. At least it's not Mugabe. You know, there's a possibility that things might be different. And there is also, and this is interesting, you know, how best to say this? Almost like in South Africa where, you know, as soon as we replaced Jacob Zuma with Cyril Ramaphosa, people sort of started to think differently about the ANC and talk differently about the ANC. You know, just changing that person gave people hope that this was a new organization. And I think the same applies to ZANU-PF.
Yeah, well,
so we got rid of Robert Mugabe, and now we're prepared to give ZANU-PF the benefit of the doubt.
Zimbabweans, and we're hoping that sort of the Liberation Party... Zimbabweans seem to be terrifically forgiving people, and South Africans are already over Ramaphosa, and Emmerson was in long before Cyril. So it just shows you that, you know, in Zim, if you wanted to really test people's patience, the best people's patience to test would be the Zimbabweans, by the looks of things.
Well, you know, Gareth, voters are not stupid. And I think they also look on the other side of the aisles and see an opposition that is pretty much in disarray, has for a long time embodied some of the sort of anti-democratic traits that you see in ZANU-PF, and is run by a young guy who, while exciting and energetic, has a very limited record when it comes to governance. Yeah. He's not necessarily a better option.
Well, Simon, this is as always very enlightening. I love talking to you, and thank you for your update this morning. The Mail and Guardian is where you can find every week something from Simon Allison, our little update on Africa this morning, the burning platform. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Gareth. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Simon Allison and the Burning Platform, brought to you by Nando's. If you want to find out more, all you need to do is head on over to Nando's and get yourself something hot to eat, and you can accompany that with a nice podcast and catch up on all the news. Lifestyle Home Garden, as you know, have redecorated our entire office here. We've got trees that are 3 meters tall. We've got plants that look like some of our presenters. We've got amazing greenery. The place feels like a tropical rainforest, and considering it's winter, that is something.
There is something so special about coming here in the morning now. Yeah. It's like a whole different level of nice.
Well, the plants make the whole place feel healthier and more alive and more vital, and I just love it. But we're talking today about herbs in your kitchen. 5 quick minutes of help to help you flourish in your living kitchen. Practical tools to help you grow and maintain herbs and all kinds of other things. Now, you can fill your kitchen and your home with the amazing, lovely scents of herbs to add to your soups, your stews, salads, drinks, and even more to create your own living kitchen. Having herbs right at hand means you can just snip off what you need without much ado about simply growing them on a bright, sunny windowsill. You know, it's easy. It's easy to do. Ben's tried it. I've tried it. Plus, you get the bright foliage of kitchen herbs, which will cheer you up throughout winter. Because God help you, if you live in the drier parts of our country during winter, it's brown. The only color you get? Brown. So at least these will help to give a little bit of green at this time of year. So here are a few essential tips for having success with kitchen herbs. First of all, they need bright light conditions and at least 4 to 6 hours of sun a day. So don't put them in some dark corner and think it's going to work. Put them in a range of your favorite pots or windowsill planters on or in front of a north or northwest facing window or windowsill. If you need to know, just pull out the compass. Most of our phones have compasses on them now.
Yep.
Right? West-facing will also do. Don't do east or south if you could possibly help it. Just think the east rand is dangerous, and just think the south rand is also dangerous.
Exactly, yeah.
So keep it west, which is where the buses stop running, and keep it north.
And the west also is where lifestyle is.
Yes, that's correct. If you don't have a sunny window, group your kitchen herbs in a large, attractive pot or wooden herb planter and place it in front of a sunny patio door. If you're able to open your kitchen window, you could also plant your herbs in a window box with brackets on the outside and pick what you need from inside. Make sure the containers you use for your kitchen herbs have adequate drainage. If you don't have good drainage, you're going to have problems. Feed your kitchen herbs once a month with a water-soluble, nitrogen-rich fertilizer or foliar feed, which is suitable for edibles, and these are organic and available from Lifestyle Home Garden. Herbs are givers. They want to be pruned, and they like being used. So you can't don't worry about overusing them. In other words, clip little bits off, use them where you need to. Cutting will often make them grow bushier and fuller. It's very important to grow herbs that you like and prefer to use. If you're still getting to know them, marking them with an attractive herb stick will help you on your way. So, you know, oregano has a certain role in the kitchen. Thyme, rosemary, mint. These are the kinds of things we're talking about. Do you use any of those, Ben?
I used to use quite a lot of oregano.
Yes.
And mint.
Oregano's lovely on pizza.
Yeah, mint's really good with lamb.
There we go. And mint's also nice in mojitos.
Or the, yeah, sure, for summer. Yeah.
And not all herbs lend themselves to indoor gardening. So, Lifestyle recommends the following herbs for your kitchen. Chives, put those in stews and soups and things. Mint, lemon balm, oregano, parsley, rosemary, sage, thyme, basil, and bay leaf. And always choose the herbs that you enjoy cooking and garnishing with. Visit the Lifestyle blog for more info with lifestyle.co.za. They tried to make it as easy as possible for you. Lifestyle.co.za. They are, of course, on the corner of Bayes Nordea and Esterhout Avenue in Rand Park Ridge, Randburg. Go to lifestyle.co.za for more. Choose your lifestyle with Lifestyle Home Garden. Brilliant. I'm actually going to plant some herbs this weekend. I'm now inspired to do it.
It just looks so good. There's no getting away from it. They are amazing to look at.
No, look at and use, and the smell's good too. Mm. You know, some people have stinky kitchens. This is a way to make it better.
Well, especially if you cook fish or something a lot.
All right, let's get into a couple of news things that are going on. There are some stories that are worth paying attention to. Ben, I know you've had your eye on one or two of them. You want to go ahead?
I haven't, Gareth.
No, you haven't.
You're wrong. I haven't had eyes on anything, really.
Sorry, I've got it. Here's something. Wealthy families have 7 qualities. Do you want to know what they are?
Loyalty, institutional wealth, curiosity, honesty.
Let's see, because the article that I'm going to quote from is by someone called Ilse Alberts. She talks about wealth as defined by an abundance of valuable possessions or money and a plentiful supply of a particular desirable thing. And she's written for a number of publications like Bloomberg. For a family to be considered high net worth, there is no higher value in the balance than human capital. So she goes into the 7 traits that you will find in wealthy families. According to her, these attributes make a family really wealthy. Number 1, the talents, personalities, and genius of each family member. Each individual family member is an asset, and each family member is a valuable source of knowledge, a potential contribution, and an inherent value because the unique individuality of each person is brought to the fore. So in other words, there isn't a weak link, right? That's yep. Number 1. Number 2, the family's story. Every family has an origin and a history. The narrative of every family is unique, playing an important role in the development of society worldwide. The choices and decisions of your previous generations have an impact on your life now. If you come from their choices, their decisions, and their actions, your choices, decisions, and actions will have an impact on the next generation for years, decades, centuries, and millennia to come. So it's important to know where you come from. Mm-hmm. That's number 2. Number 3. The mental abilities and exposure to education. Growing up in a family with financial means to afford excellent education contributes to the advancement of the mental capacity of the family. The different life experiences, exposure to global experiences through travel and knowledge all contribute to the wealth of the family's mental capital. So number 3, improve your mind. And these families do. Number 4, the emotional intelligence of the family. Families with exposure to wealth have more opportunities to develop their emotional intelligence because they can afford to pay for mental health services, personal life coaches, programs and seminars that teach emotional intelligence. Money doesn't buy happiness, but money can make many opportunities possible for self-development, empowerment, and EQ. Makes sense.
It does, really does.
That's number 4. Number 5, health and vitality. Don't ever underestimate this one. The more the members of a family feel meaning in their lives, the higher value they'll place on health and vitality because the body is treated as the vehicle to take extraordinary service to the world. Number 6, social network and interactions. So remember, we're talking about the reasons that certain families end up wealthy. Number 6 is that family members build a network over their lifetimes. Like attracts like, and the quality of friendships and social networks is a reflection of the characteristics of that family. The lack of quality friendships equally reflects lack of family to build endearing friendships with significant people outside of the family bonds. In other words, if you don't have a great network of achievers outside of your family, your family won't be enough on its own. And the final characteristic of a wealthy family, if you're trying to build one or you'd like to know whether your family could be considered wealthy, a family's financial wealth. It seems obvious, right?
But yeah.
This is built either by a man or a woman, or by a man and a woman who perceive a big void in the financial well-being and therefore in the financial well-being of their family. The big void acts as a driving force and an intrinsic motivation to build wealth for the family. The void or absence of financial means becomes the fuel in the family wealth engine. So in other words, it's not that you have money, it's that you want to have money that makes you successful.
Hmm.
Isn't that interesting? So in other words, if you just have tons of resources and you've got no motivation to get more,
yeah,
you won't necessarily build more. You won't add value back into the system. So I thought for a Friday morning, you needed to hear these seven things. If you want to create a family that's wealthy, you want to give them all the material needs and comforts that they require to keep advancing.
But that's just it. It's like it's real wealth. It's not just like a good year or something.
That's right. You can find those articles also on the internet. I found that via biznews.com this morning. All right, let's get into some other things because I know Toby Shapshak is chomping at the bit to speak to us this morning. Toby is about to launch something very cool, the Creativate Art Digital Arts Festival. It's an exploration and a celebration. And Creativate is what they're calling it. Is that right? Creativate?
Indeed. Can you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear. Hi, Tobes.
Good morning.
Good. So what's Creativate? Who came up with that word?
Well, it's a combination. Tony Lancaster is the man who had the brainchild for this great event. Okay. And the word Creativate is a combination of creativity and innovate.
Nice.
And I think it's appropriate because, you know, a digital artist is kind of at the tipping point, isn't it? There's so much amazing technology that's part of our everyday reality that we use all the time. And as soon as we start to use new technology, we start to explore how to use it in terms of art. You know, I've been asked a lot lately about, you know, is it art? Is it the orphan child? What really is art? And of course, I think about this. I come from a very arty family. My grandfather was a sculptor. Mm. My father's an artist. And I think about it in terms of what is art supposed to do? You know, I was taken to art galleries my whole life by my parents who loved art. My father was really mad for Picasso. Mm-hmm. There's a quirky little thing about Picasso, by the way. There's a museum in Paris with all of Picasso's amazing amounts of Picasso material and work and old stuff. And it's housed in the house that used to be the home of the Marquis de Sade, the man who gave us the word sadism. So what is art supposed to do? It's supposed to make you think about your existence or your culture or reflect on the society that we live in. And that's what art's all about. So, of course, people are going to use the media that are available to them. In Picasso's day, it was paint. You know, what Picasso was so remarkable for was using this totally different painting technique instead of this kind of photorealism that – all of his predecessors had done. He started doing a kind of impressionism that you know would make him famous and iconic, and he would start to look at different shapes and different forms. Most famously, there's an African context to this. He used wooden African masks in his breakthrough piece. So that's what art's all about. And now we live in a digital age where we have all of these digital technologies available to us.
All right, let me just presuppose that I have an idea of where you're going in this, because you are not involved in art galleries and things. You know, you got Stuff Magazine, which is the premier publication in South Africa for gadgets, for technology, for mobile phones, for music, for games, for all of this stuff. And we love the magazine for those reasons, but you don't really have an art section. There are so many creative people in South Africa who've never really had an opportunity to show on a digital format what they're capable of creatively. So you're saying
I agree.
You're going to make this festival an entry point for those people.
Yes, and I can't take any credit for it. It is a sub festival of the National Arts Festival, and Tony Lancaster, the Arts Festival CEO, it was his idea and his brainchild, and he brought me on board to help with it. And I've got to say, the array of artists, both local and international, that we've pulled together is really fantastic. And this is just the first year. I mean, we have much broader ideas. I mean, some of the local people who are going to be demonstrating and talking about this stuff, there's a great guy called Yav Dagan who works with William Kentridge on his video installations, on video in general, on creating museums for art. He's going to look at that. Darren Chats is an exceptionally gifted photographer and filmmaker. I mean, he just oozes talent. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be looking at a variety of things. One of the things he's been working on is a invisible exhibition. So it's an augmented reality exhibition. You use your phone to look at an art exhibition that isn't technically there, but is there. Wow. In augmented reality. Some really interesting, smart people. Bradley Kirschenbaum, the guy who's created this amazing Love Josie brand.
Yes.
All of these T-shirts. You know, he's busy putting together a book about it, of the history of this brand of T-shirts. But he was so attuned to what was going on in the country and the city at the same time that it's a history of where South Africa was each year when he brought out a different collection. And, of course, is a T-shirt art? I mean, we probably stopped saying a T-shirt was art in the 70s, you know, when the smiley face peaked as – but it is. It is a very clever reflection of the state of the city, from, you know, xenophobic attacks to the death of Mandela to the rise of Zuma to, you know, and the way he interpreted it was much more thoughtful and deep thinking. So these are the kinds of things that we're going to look at.
You put a very good explanation together of what Picasso did for impressionist art, and you talked about the painting. So here you've given me a couple of examples, and maybe we must just spend a minute thinking about the others, because digital art could encompass a huge variety of things. I mean, a lot of people think that when they think digital art, it's pure, you know, graphic art. It's
painting.
Yeah. It's design, that it's all about, you know, logos or cartoons or animations or virtual reality or augmented reality. But in effect, it could be a number of things that we wouldn't normally consider. Give me a couple of categories that surprise you and might surprise us.
Well, let's just look quickly at let's double click on virtual reality, because one of the exhibitions we've got is a Danish company called Doghouse, and you put on virtual reality goggles and you sit around a dinner table. It's only about a 20 or 30 minute digital experience, and it runs through the day. And yet, I don't want to give anything away. It's a very clever use of virtual reality for an experience of something, and you start to interact with it. I suppose, Gareth, that's the big thing about digital technologies, is there's an interactivity that is involved. I mean, you know, who would have thought game design is an art form? And yet,
of course,
I mean, there are museum exhibitions of this stuff. I'm working I'm interviewing a South African who's worked on this utterly extraordinary new game. I'm going to send him your way. You guys have got to interview him. And it's just beautiful. I mean, it's such a poignant reflection of society where we are. And, of course, this South African is working on the sound effects of it. I mean, sound has become such an integral part to our modern-day experience. You know, you go to so many museum exhibitions, and there's always a soundtrack to it. You know, great artists often, or current artists, have a visualization not just of what they want you to see and experience from seeing stuff, but they add a sound component to it. You know, interestingly, fashion designers have been doing that for years.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of their show. So these are some of the kinds of ideas. You know, Glenn von Lochenberg, he's an incredibly successful guy in the video production industry. You know, he does a lot of work for MultiChoice. His company, Don't Look Down, is very well known. And yet his side gig, as it were, he's this unbelievable DJ who travels the world. Mm-hmm. and does these exceptional DJs. So we're going to get him to do some stuff around DJing. You know, part of the conference is to appeal to youngsters, to kids in school, and say, these are the potential careers you could follow. You know, I don't think you and I had those opportunities when we were at high school. No one said, hey, you know, these are the creative fields you might one day want to consider.
Yeah, but it's probably just as well, because we would have foisted our ugly art on people. So maybe we did them a favor. But this is terrific. Okay, so it's part of the National Arts Festival in Grahamstown.
Yes.
And so people can experience this. It's not just something that you can go and look at, and there's going to be, it's going to appeal to all five senses in very many cases. It's really going to be a different and novel development on the idea of an exhibition or an installation. This is the new world of art.
Indeed, indeed. And it's not just, you know, it's exhibitions, it's workshops, it's lectures, it's a range of things. We've put together quite a comprehensive bunch of events and things to do that are all artistic related. And of course, it fits within the broader program of the National Arts Festival.
Are you going to go? It's such a schlep to Grahamstown. Are you going to go?
Of course, of course. I went to university there. I have a very fond memory of the town. I don't know when you last went to the Arts Festival. It is fantastic. I mean, the big musical act this year is Suzanne Vega, who I'm unfortunately missing. She's coming the second weekend. Yeah, no, I don't know. Did she do Red Balloons?
Sorry, she did Luca.
She did Luca. There's some really big events going on. You know, I really loved. I studied drama for my first year at varsity. I was particularly no good.
Wow. Did you guys do that bullshit of sitting around a tree and contemplating the universe and having to write your feelings down in a scrapbook? That kind of nonsense.
No, I think that was just being at university in Grahamstown in the 80s. What can I say? That was just part of the latter-day hippie culture that was then there. Anyway, the interesting thing is that, you know, there's so much else that it fits into. And it's I like that it dovetails between the more traditional forms of art, theater, dance, music. I mean, there's a great selection of jazz. Personally, I've never really gotten dance, you know, music, no. A movement kind of art form. I don't really get it, but I really do get theater. I do get painting. I do get music, the traditional forms. And yet, you know, if we look back in 20 years' time, we're going to look at some of the nascent technology now, and it's going to be traditional. That's how we'll describe it. You know, VR will probably be traditional. The kinds of things that we're looking at now and thinking are so cutting edge and innovative and new and great new ways to explore it. In 20 years' time, it'll be a generation later, and it'll be what's always been around. So, but now this is the chance to kind of look at these new technologies and look at what people are doing. And there really isn't anything quite like this in South Africa at the moment.
Well, let's go and see it. It sounds terrific.
Indeed.
Yeah, thank you, Toby. Toby Shapshak is he's the boss of Stuff Magazine. He's the editor-in-chief and publisher. So go and find out more. You'll be obviously cover some of this in your magazine.
Of course. Well, in that and in other formats.
All right, good. And we can go and check it out on the web as well. There's always lots of info there. Social media is full of useful references too. And you can go along to the actual arts festival and find out more. Toby, lovely to talk to you, man.
Thanks a lot, Gareth.
Have a good weekend.
You too.
There we go. Toby Shapshak. Okay. Lots of other stuff to talk about this morning. I want to squeeze in as much as we can before we have to go. Messages. Mike and the Mechanic said it all before. Every generation blames the one before. Michelle, I'm not sure what that's related to, but it may have something to do with our discussion with Simon Allison. Why are parts of the show like the Money Shot and Ben's Sport on the Google Podcast app, but the actual show isn't? I don't know. It might be that you're looking it up wrong, because it all should be there.
I know that's something quite new for us, so we're implementing new things on the Google.
Well, they just released this week a brand new Google Podcast app, which is for Android only, and there wasn't such a thing before, so it was much harder for people on Android to be able to listen. So hopefully we'll figure that out for you in the next few days. I was listening to yesterday's podcast, says somebody, All Brand Stark and the Fat Camp Resort. You guys are really, really funny. I laughed nonstop. Almost crashed my car. And then someone else saying South Africa's been voted the most romantic country in the world. We eat dinner by candlelight every night, brought to you by Eskom. Isn't that nice? So lots of other messages. It's time to check in with George Meany. He's here. We're going to catch up on some of the motoring news of the week, some of the big stories in cars, and sometimes even some stuff that affects other lifestyle areas that you didn't even think cars were involved with. How are you, George?
Good on you, Gareth.
Good. Had a good week?
Yeah, I did. How you been?
Yeah, all right, sir. Not so bad. Still here.
Still, yeah. I made you run toward that mic.
Yeah.
So it's the French or France Formula One Grand Prix this weekend.
Oh crap! I knew I forgot something in sport today.
Well, that's why I'm here, Ben. I'm here to cover for you.
Yeah. If you didn't, no one would. Trust me. Ben has no interest. He's just completely useless when it comes to that stuff.
I don't know. I've heard him bet. Lewis Hamilton a couple of times.
All right. Well, let's hear what's happening in the French Grand Prix. Is there anything exciting? Anything we're expecting that will change the kind of expected outcome of such a thing?
Well, the Mercedes-Benz team didn't bring their new engine to the last Grand Prix, mm-hmm. and they used their old engine, whereas the other teams brought their new engines. So, and they didn't do too badly. So what eventually happened was Vettel obviously won the race. He's now 1 point ahead in the championship, and between him and Hamilton, it's neck and neck. So it's an exciting year, I think, with no one team really running away from the pack. But what's interesting, and that happened this week, is that Alonso, who is also a Formula One driver, won the Le Mans in a Toyota. And
a Toyota. Is that unusual?
It is, because it's the second Japanese car company to win since 1991. The last one was Mazda in 1991. So Toyota almost won last year, but eventually had engine trouble, and Porsche won. And Porsche pulled out this year. So it remains to be seen what happens with Porsche in the years to come. But Alonso's shooting for what's called the Triple Crown. Triple Crown is winning the Le Mans, winning the Monaco Grand Prix, which is already done, and winning the Indianapolis 500.
Wow, that would be quite an achievement.
I would say
so. Just while we're on Formula One, I saw Nico Rosberg in a Heineken ad the other day. He's promoting safe driving. In other words, not drinking and driving, which is interesting. It's quite a cool take on these boring public service announcements that you're forced to do by government because they're trying to stop people from driving drunk. He says, when you drive, never drink, no compromise. And he, it shows him kind of racing his car, and then they all go out to celebrate, and all the other guys drink, and they offer him a beer, and he goes, "No, guys, no compromise." I mean, it's kind of
cool.
As bad as these ads can be, that's a good one.
Yeah, yeah.
I liked it, and I didn't know who the hell Nico Rosberg was. I had to look it up, but there we go. I thought it was a good ad.
I think it's good that these guys are getting involved because they've got big followings. So, they can do something good good on Heineken.
And it's a nicely put together ad, and I thought it was interesting that Heineken are going that way.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Well, I saw a beer not so long ago. What is it? What did this beer say?
Eventually, if we take this to its logical conclusion, beers are going to have labels on them that say "Don't drink me."
Well,
ultimately, that's where it's going, right?
It had a play on I'll look it up and I'll tweet it at you. It was a beer that did play on the other beer companies, mm-hmm. And the tagline was something like "Thank you for building our brand."
Oh.
You've probably seen it before. I'll look it up. Anyway, the Volvo is committed to taking their recycled plastics in their car from 5% to 25% by the year 2025. Believe it or not, cars only have 5% recycled material in them. Okay. Dashboards are plastic, door panels are plastic. 5 to 25%, what I was surprised by was the 5%. Shooting for 25% by 20. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And a lot of the stuff, what do they do when a car is in an accident, for example? They just throw that plastic away.
Yeah. Becomes crushed.
Fortune in plastic. Now, I drove past a place on Sunday where they had a whole lot of scrap cars, these cars that have been in accidents or cars that had just rusted beyond belief. I just saw it was like a graveyard. And I wondered what happens to all the soft parts of those cars. Cause you can see the metal's all rusting.
Yeah.
It's lying in the sun. But, those cars probably once had leather seats.
Yeah.
That leather is all wasted.
Yeah.
And it was probably in many of them in okay condition.
Yeah.
Obviously, well, some you've got to throw away. Yeah. Some of the, as you say, the interior door panels, the dashboards. Yeah, the plastic parts of the car, you could reuse those.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose the metals and You know, and the natural materials are okay to just leave there, but it's the plastics and that stuff that's going to stuff up the environment.
It's not going to decay on its own.
Yeah, exactly.
Metal will rust, wood will rot, but plastic doesn't go anywhere. So tell me, Volvo doing this?
Volvo are doing this. Okay, yeah,
good for
so,
Volvo.
You know, Volvo and. You know, maybe they're changing their path from being the safest car because Tesla's giving them a go to being environmentally friendly.
Well, that's very Scandinavian of them.
Maybe.
Okay.
And then a car company called Panos. Panos.
That's a horrible name.
It is a horrible name. It's even hard to say.
Panos.
It's an American sports car company, and they are painting all of their cars with what's called a memory polymer. If you scratch the car, light scratches, the paint heals itself. Apparently, it's standard stuff now.
That's fantastic. Tell me more.
You have to park the car in the sun or use a hairdryer on it, but any circular scratches or fine scratches will heal with heat.
That sounds fantastic. Almost too good to be true.
The problem with this Panos sports car is that it's $159,000 and doesn't come to South Africa.
It's probably just as well. All right. Well, that's
and after a busy week, that's it.
Well, you had a busy week this week. You also had your dealer masterclass, which is interesting. I went along to that too. So it's where Auto Trader get to share some of the insights that you guys have in the market with a bunch of dealers. There are 2,000 dealers across the country. I didn't
roughly.
Know that.
Yeah,
that's
roughly.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And how is the market at the moment?
It's tough. I mean, there is a lot of activity, which makes the market turn into, which, you know, happens in every market, into a long tail. Those guys that do it well do really well. Those guys that, you know, don't come along for the ride, don't do really well and fall off the right hand side of that curve. So it's tough for some, okay for most, and really good for others, you know, and that's every single market.
Yeah, I suppose the best will rise to the top in these sort of situations. And when things are hard, you really get tested.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's
or you fall off.
Yeah, you know, it's keeping your costs low, keeping your kind of bottom line as tidy as possible. But you sell on Auto Trader, you guys sell new cars and you sell used cars.
Yeah.
What's the breakdown there? I mean, I'm just curious because we haven't really spoken about this in a long time. How many people buying used cars? How many people buying new cars? And how long do they hold on to new cars for?
The ratio between new cars traded in the country versus used cars traded in the country is roughly 65-35.
Wow. That's not quite a lot of new cars.
It is a lot of new cars. And that's not uncommon in the world except for India. India is the one that's closest to 50-50.
Really?
Yeah.
How come? How do they do that?
Because they've got manufacturers mainly.
Are they selling very cheap cars?
And I think the cost of their production is low. Maybe it's because of the size of their population.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you've got a billion people,
you've got a lot of spending power.
A billion potential drivers.
Yeah.
They better build one big road. The whole of India is just going to be tarred.
One big road. The Autobahn.
Yeah.
So the
Indobahn.
The Indo.
Telling you. Watch the space.
The Indobahn. Well, I mean, if you go to the East and you watch how they drive, I'd be worried.
Yeah, listen, I mean, aren't they making those very cheap Tatas at the moment?
Yeah.
You can get them for a couple of thousand dollars equivalent, and like a family could pull their money, and then at least, you know, the whole family of like 10 people or whatever could buy one car, which they wouldn't have otherwise. There wouldn't be any cars, so it gives people that kind of first step on the ladder to owning a vehicle which will help them to trade, to be able to move around a little bit, to be able to get out there.
Yeah.
Clearly, if you're stuck, if you're static, you can't do as much as people who
you
are
can't
mobile.
Be involved in the economy, really, if you're not mobile. But the ratio in South Africa is roughly 65-35. On our site, it's mainly used cars. We've got just over 70,000 cars, of which about 5,000 or 6,000 are new. New cars. So, but we know that about a third of the people visiting our website are in the market for a new car or a used car. And two thirds of the market are in the market for, two thirds of the visitors are in the market only for a used car.
So I think that there are probably different kinds of people who come onto your site. I imagine some of them are there just for price. they're looking for the best price for what they want. Some of them are there because they want a particular car, and then they'll compare them.
Yep. Yep.
Others probably are just looking to find a bargain.
Yep.
And don't care what the car is.
Yeah, I mean, we call it anybody that's not serious, and we try and play in the what we call the in-market car shopper part of the buying funnel. Mm-hmm. So we market to in-market car shoppers mainly, so that people that come and sell on our site know that they're getting access to an audience that's serious. Mm-hmm. The rest of the guys that are still researching, we call them car porn surfers.
Yeah. That's I've done that before. You know, you go on there and you just have a look.
Yeah.
You imagine, I'd look good in that car. I wouldn't mind driving that thing around. That looks fantastic.
Exactly.
So go and take a look. Autotrader.co.za for all the information. Over 67,000 cars. Actually, 70,000 I see your ticker saying here. That's amazing. Hmm. What comes up first here? A Volkswagen Polo Hatch 1.2 TSI for 240,000 rand.
Hmm. Still the most popular car in South
Good
Africa.
Good car. Hmm. Yeah, that's very nice. All right, George. Thanks, man.
Cheers.
And there's a Lamborghini Aventador. 2017. 13,999,999 rand.
We'll buy it on Tuesday.
Oof. And it's black. It looks so good. 3,600 Ks on the clock. Mm. 2017 model. God, this is car porn. You see, I'm getting into this.
You're getting into car porn. I see that.
Man, this is good. I'm so bored with my car. It's time to change.
Really? There's a Lamborghini on the market.
Yeah,
quite
sure.
Conveniently.
Yeah. You know what's not on the market? The 13 million I don't have. 14 if you add the nines at the end there. All right. Thanks very much, George.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks, everybody. That's a wrap on the week. Have an excellent time on cliffcentral.com today. Of course, Friday is a very busy day. We've got Dave and the comedy, Just Now Comedy podcast coming in. We've got Casper a little bit later on, Sex Talk with John T. It's always your favorite day. It's my favorite day on cliffcentral.com. Stick around for all of that. We will see you on Monday. Don't forget, we've got an interview with Judith Sipuma on next to keep you entertained. You want to hear Judith's story? This is where it is.
This is cliffcentral.com.